Thanks for listening to this podcast of APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio show. Our collective focuses on issues relevant to APA communities and features an angry APA minute where listeners like you can sound off. We promote social justice, feature APA arts and culture, and challenge how APAs are represented in the media. If you have a story idea or would like to contribute, leave us a message on our Facebook page, APA Compass Radio. APA Compass airs at 9 a.m. on the first Friday of each month on Portland's KBOO 90.7 FM and at www.kboo.fm. Or you can download podcasts of our program at kboo.fm/APACOMPASS. That's kboo.fm/APACompass. Thanks again for listening.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass. I'm Sarika Mehta. Vijay Iyer is a Grammy-nominated jazz musician and winner of the 2013 MacArthur Genius Grant. The music you're listening to is from the Vijay Iyer Trio's latest album, Break Stuff. Something I personally appreciate about Vijay is his social justice engagement. You sometimes might catch him tweeting remarks about hashtag Black Lives Matter, or he challenges us to critically think about what it means to be Asian American and the relationship with Black lives in America. I caught up with Vijay while he was on tour for the Portland Jazz Festival. We met up at the Hotel Monaco downtown, and we talked about these issues. We began our conversation talking about the keynote speech he had given, which was called The Complicity of Excess, and this was given to Yale alumni. The keynote was transcribed and posted on the Asian American Writers Workshop website, and then it went viral.
I mean, it ended up kind of, someone who was at the alumni reunion is Ken Chen, who's the director of the Asian American Writers Workshop, which is a wonderful place in New York. They host really interesting readings, and also the website, aaww.org, I think, is really full of brilliant observations and writings by interesting folks. So, and they keep adding new content. It's really exciting to see what they're doing. So he actually, after I gave that speech, he came up to me and said, well, we'd like to publish it. And at first I sort of sat on it for a while. And then finally I just wasn't sure what would happen. I don't know. It's always weird being a person of color in public because lots of things. I don't know. I don't even know how to even begin with that. But I felt that it might create a disturbance in my own sort of path or something, or just might create ripples of some kind. And then finally I said, you know what? Just grow a pair and do it. So that's what I did. I said, finally, okay, yes. Yeah, you should publish it. And I didn't think that part of me was thinking, it's just Asian American Writers Workshop. I mean, no one's going to read this thing. And then it kind of went viral. And now it's basically like the number one article on that site. So that's what I get. Basically what I was saying, you know, this is partly in response to the situation, you know, to be at Yale giving a talk to Asian Americans, it's partly like, what does it mean to gather as Asian Americans? Secondly, what does it mean to do it at Yale? So there were kind of two identities being posited that I found to be sort of a little bit wishful. One was what, you know, the Yale alum as a sort of kind of person, as if we all have something in common because we gave a bunch of money to Yale. and then the second was the idea of an Asian American or something, you know, like some sort of sense of community that is supposed to emerge through this disparate range of experiences. And So I kind of was asking basically in that speech, and asking myself too, because I think about this all the time, and it's been, you know, you could say that my life and as an artist has been about that question, is what is it, what is this us that we're here to celebrate? What does it mean to be Asian American, and particularly to be Yale Asian Americans? What I sort of submitted to everybody is that basically what it means is that we're in, well, we got here by succeeding, and to succeed in America means that you are basically okay with America, with the idea of America, which is a country that's founded on slavery and genocide. And, you know, that sounds like, well, of course, we all have to live with that every day. And it's, you know, it's something we conveniently forget. But, you know, gathering as people of color in America, like, basically, what is your relationship to anti-blackness? That's partly what I was asking. Are you here because you don't have to deal with that? Because you conveniently are able to forget it? And narratives of success and, like, immigrants who strive and all that, that basically is a way of bypassing the fact of blackness in America, because those people weren't immigrants. You know, they were brought here forcibly and treated as property. So, and then we live in the aftermath of all of that. So I guess I just wanted to submit that as, like, just kind of, I don't know, I was kind of being... a bit of a jerk, because, like, basically I was asked to give some inspiring closing remarks at this gathering, and basically what I wanted to do instead was sort of like create some kind of rupture or some sort of like break or something, like, what are we even doing here? You know, that kind of thing. So I tried to be nice, but I also was sort of like, you know, we need to rethink this whole enterprise. That was basically my premise.
I don't think it was jerky. I kind of thought it was really ballsy, but we all have our perspectives.
And, well, I guess, you know, the fact that it went viral in the way that it did suggests that it touched a nerve somehow. I think maybe it's something that people maybe had lurking in the back of their minds but hadn't really thought about how to articulate. And my premise, you know, basically what I said at the end of it was, like, if we're going to talk about an us, we need to be an us who cares about people other than ourselves, you know? And that means particularly fighting for justice for others. And that's that should be obvious, but it isn't.
Precisely. I guess we should probably talk about your music. Your newest album is called Break Stuff. So tell us about it and how it differs from your other albums.
Well, the album is it's a trio album. I've had this trio for almost a dozen years with these same gentlemen, Marcus Gilmore on drums and Stefan Crump on bass. And the reason it's called Break Stuff is not because I'm into Limp Bizkit. Somebody finally revealed to me after I had decided on the title that someone had already taken that title. But what I found is that most jazz people don't know that, so that's good. But I'm also, you know, I'm here to reclaim the title for non-Limp Bizkit people in general. It's called Break Stuff because it's stuff that happens in the breaks. It's sort of, I'm interested in how things grow when we don't expect or force them to. And that's sort of how this trio has evolved over the years. It started as part of a quartet that we had for some years, and sometimes we would do trio pieces in the breaks in the quartet set. Okay. And then we had the opportunity to tour in Europe as a trio, and then we were offered a record deal while we were in Europe. It was pretty surprising, and as a trio, and it wasn't even, it was, to me, it was sort of like, this is just a sort of provisional thing I'm doing right now. So it wasn't that, I mean, it kind of became plan A. It was originally sort of like, let me do this for a while I figure out what to do next. And then it became the thing that I was doing, you know, that we were doing together. And it really just evolved in a very natural way, just by being patient and listening to each other. And, you know, I would write material and we'd also take on other material, including maybe most famously Galang by MIA and Human Nature, Michael Jackson song, a couple other things. So we've made a few albums in this configuration, and this is the third. This time I felt confident about really making it about our music, original music. But a lot of the music that we did on this album is adapted from other projects, and so it all has this sense of like reduction or repurposing or kind of doing something it's not supposed to do. And when we do that, it sort of just takes us outside of ourselves, and that's kind of part of the process for me, a process of transformation and growth. So I like this album, and I hope you do too.
I talk to a lot of artists of color, get frustrated about being kind of forced into a niche audience or labeled, and it's very hard to become mainstream. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they're trying to be loyal. Do you ever have any experiences like this? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, the thing is that music works in ways that sometimes people don't realize. You know, niches are that's the work of the the marketplace. It's sort of a way of selling you or preventing you from being sold so that someone else can sell something else instead of you. Pigeonholing is a way of sort of like reducing what people do to styles or labels or categories or isms, you know. But music is much more of a open process than that. I've just sort of come to realize this from doing it, you know, that it does its own kind of work of reaching people. And I don't mean critics, I mean people. And I don't mean musicians either. I mean regular people. The way that music can kind of put an experience in your body and give you a shared collective experience with others, that it creates a sort of bond. That does its own work that words cannot even reach, you know. And so I have come to just trust and believe in that process above all. And that's why I keep making music. Not because I'm trying to combat what some dumb blogger said somewhere. Or, you know. I mean, this album came out last week, and I've been a bit frustrated because 100% of the reviews have been written by white men. 100. I mean, like, all of them. I'm talking about a few dozen. You know? Like, it's kind of... And it becomes fatiguing after a while because they all say the same stuff. All the reviews are kind of laced with microaggressions. You know, it's kind of like, oh, well, like they are always saying that I make mathematical music. Oh. That's an example. You know, I mentioned that in that speech, actually. Mm-hmm. These sort of like model minority logic that frames the way some of these critics will respond. And it's partly because, for one thing, in jazz, at least, it's white men who do all the talking, and they do make all the decisions about who should play where, who gets what record deal, who gets written about in what magazine, right? So it's they who are starting from this set of assumptions about you, about what you should and should not be doing, or what kind of freedom you should be afforded or should be revoked from you, you know. So it's, you know, they're not able to actually hear what's happening with a sort of open heart. And so what I find, that's what I mean by it, you know, music bypasses all that when it's actually made for and with and among people. So that's kind of the process that I stake my life on.
It's a good note to end on. Thank you so much, Vijay Iyer, for chatting with me today.
Thank you.
That was Grammy-nominated jazz musician Vijay Iyer of the Vijay Iyer Trio. The music you hear is from their latest album, Break Stuff. You can learn more at vijay-iyer.com. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.